Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you work anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. For our topic today, we're going back to protests. Kevin brought in a couple of his Skyway Acquisition team members to answer the question, should I protest, from both the government perspective and the industry perspective. Steve Lucianetti spent over 30 years on the government side in the contracting world. Christy Gilbert has spent the same amount of time as a contracts and proposal manager on the industry side. We get to listen in as they provide sometimes surprising answers to Kevin's questions. This episode is brought to you by Skyway Acquisition. To get more content and context from Skyway's team of former contracting officers, get a personal membership to the Skyway community. Visit skywaymember.com to learn more. Now let's get started with Should I Protest?
Protests aren't fun, I mean, for either side. However, the reasons that companies protest aren't very fun either. I mean, you have a reason to do it, right? They feel they've been slighted in some way or something. So in this episode, we kind of want to go over why protests happen and also talk about some factors that go into why you decide to protest. And I got Steve and also Christy can kind of help balance out the conversation today. What are we talking about today in this episode? Protests. We'll do some FAR time here. So protest means, and this is from FAR 33-101, is a written objection by an interested party to any of the following. And there are four things basically that can be protested. A solicitation, a cancellation of a solicitation, an award of a proposed award to a contract to someone, and then a termination or cancellation of an award if the written objection contains allegations that the termination or cancellation is based upon, in whole or in part, on improprieties concerning the award of the contract. In other words, the contract was terminated and it didn't seem right. So those are the four things that can be protested. There's a whole lot of arguments around when they happen, but those are the four basic things. And we have a separate podcast. In fact, I think we have two of them focusing specifically on protests. So let's start with the first question, get you guys in the conversation. I'm talking too much. Why do you think protests matter?
Well, they matter because contractors have invested a lot of money in these proposals. And if they aren't awarded the contract, they don't get ever reimbursed for that. And they've also lost the opportunity for work for their employees and, you know, the continuation of their business, profit for their shareholders. So it with the investment of cost in these, especially these larger proposals, it's a significant lost cost to the company.
Does it matter what size the company is? Does it matter how big their proposal is?
Well, it makes a difference because the cost of protesting is high. So if the benefit you're going to realize from being successful is not high enough to justify the cost of protesting, then, you know, you'd have to consider that. So to that extent, yes, it does matter how large the proposal is and how much you've invested in it.
What do you think, Steve?
My first 20 years, protests were rare and usually appropriate. There has been a sea change in terms of GAO's approach to viewing protests. They used to be very much on the side of the government, and I feel, based on actual experience, that they have gone to the side of the contractor is usually right, and the government, if there's a protest, the government must have done something wrong. So very quick to rule against the government, have them go back and take corrective action, which is usually what you wind up doing if a GAO come back to you and say, look, you got to go back and fix this, do this, and then try again. Yeah, industry has taken advantage of that in many cases. I know of a situation where a lawyer would make money just protesting pre-solicitation stuff. He just would protest size standard. He would protest the requirement without having any knowledge. He just would file a protest. And that, unfortunately, is the one thing that anyone can do. All you need is a stamp and an address to send it to. And you can file a protest with GAO. And the interested party thing, if it's pre-solicitation, you're an interested party. If it's post-solicitation, you will have to bid. That is a situation that I would always tell contractors. If you don't bid, you can't come back later and complain that we aced you out or, you know, made a requirement restrictive. Because if you didn't bid or didn't protest the requirement before the solicitation closed, You can't come back and make that argument after the solicitation has gone through the evaluation process. If you bid, you can argue that the evaluation wasn't done correctly, but you can't go back and argue that the requirement was unduly restrictive. So it's a little bit complex, but when you go to file that protest, but GAO has really come down more on the side of industry than I've ever seen in my career.
Are you seeing the same thing, Christy?
I agree. When I was working years and years ago for a satellite company, we protested an award and the protest was upheld. And that was a rare, rare thing at that point. So it was also very rare that anybody protested. And some of it might have been the cost. Some of it was probably, you know, everybody had their favorite customers and you certainly don't want to anger your customers. So you were very particular about whether you protested or not.
About 6-8 years ago, we were putting we had a solicitation out for a new bomb rack, which is something used to drop weapons. And the company protested, and GAO went through our evaluation, and in my opinion, found very small, minor deviations from the evaluation that it's big. It was huge, a lot of money. Nothing's ever perfect, but they focused on those enough for us to go back, take corrective action, go back and redo the evaluation. We wound up with the same decision because the product being offered was far superior to what the protester was. But at that time, budget got tight. We were a year and a half behind schedule. It hit the chop block. And guess what? You know what the alternative was? The in-production bomb rack was made by the protester. He wound up actually coming out in that situation. Very frustrating because the fleet did not get a better bomb rack. But that's what can happen. I mean, they didn't intentionally manipulate the system to be evil, but that's the kind of atmosphere that is out there nowadays.
So I had one that I think the protest was winnable by the government. I was a contracting officer and they protested the strategy we had used and how well we had evaluated somebody. And the argument was we hadn't evaluated them well enough. And I had all kinds of evidence saying that, yeah, we have. Well, I went to GAO and they kind of made the case that, well, you could see how this is fuzzy, so we should do a corrective action. And my attitude was, it's not that fuzzy. Let's finish the fight this is a contentious issue because it's costing us time, et cetera, right? The culture of the government at that time, maybe it still is, and my leadership basically said, you know what, just make the corrective action and keep going.
Well, I've never had the experience where a protest has been sent back for corrective action and we felt the need to protest again after the corrective action or to initiate another protest on something else just because it was sent back. Again, the cost to industry, you know, the government has attorneys on staff, so to speak. So they're paying their salaries regardless. In the industry side, if you're going to protest, you're going to hire an outside counsel. And it's very expensive, very expensive to find an expert in government protests. So the cost factor makes you not want to go back again and again and again unless you really have something with some teeth in it.
The atmosphere nowadays is so, let's protect industry because government is always doing something wrong. And it's very frustrating for the contracting community because you spend an inordinate amount of time now. That's why solicitations take so long to get out, because you have to make sure that you have watertight requirements and page lengths and how many words and all of that stuff, because you don't want to wind up having a protest over something silly like, you know, how many pages you can submit in your proposal. I think a lot of times they protest because they really don't understand what they were told in the debrief. And they think, you know what, I want somebody else to go help me. And GAO can help them because GAO then becomes another review of the award decision to say, did you guys do what you said you were going to do? And then industry, the smaller guys feel, well, okay, if GAO says it's all right, then it must have been all right. But it's so easy to protest, you can use GAO to do, as that last line of defense to try and you know, win the contract.
So it's interesting that from the government perspective, it's easy to protest, but from Christie's perspective, it's expensive and timely. So,
well, it is expensive, but Steve's mention of debrief brings to mind one of the major problems from the industry viewpoint is that you don't get enough information anymore in the debriefs to know whether you really have an argument for protest. It appears that they're trying to give you as little information as possible, thinking maybe that opens the door. The more they give you, the more opportunity or the more you have to protest. But I think it's the other way around on the industry's perspective. They don't give you enough information to be able to determine, I really don't have a case for a protest. And I think that's part of the reason that there's been more and more. Back in the day, and then this is a long time ago, we knew our customers better. We had a closer, more personal relationship with them. And we probably got information outside of the formal debrief that would have allowed us to say, we can't win this. Why we should not protest. We can't win a protest. We know why we didn't win. And it's a valid reason.
Christy, I agree with you that absolutely. I give as little information as possible in a debrief for the exact reason that you said that. But by rule, I can only discuss with a contractor his proposal. I cannot tell you in that debrief what the other guy proposed. For example, I'll go back to the bomb wreck. One of the big things that helped the other guy win was he could carry more practice weapons than the guy who lost. Can't tell him that, but that was a big factor. I can tell you that you were adequate here or satisfactory in that category, but the other guy, he doesn't know that he was excellent or whatever the rating was at the superior at the time because he had a capability that he could deliver to us. And so the only way you can sometimes find that out is to go back. You'll never find that out through the protest. But yes, we do try to limit information because we don't want to get into a big fight over, well, I don't think Bob is as good as my guy, Joe. I've seen those arguments in service contracts where I don't think that, I know that company. They're not giving you the really, our people are better than their people. I can't answer that. And I've had protests over that. And it gets down to, what was your description of your key personnel? Did they meet the key personnel? If they did, I was one of the few recently that I've seen where GAOs come on the government side and said, you can't argue about whether Bob is better than Joe. You just, that's not a justification of argument unless you can say that we did not follow the requirements for that key position. If that person met it, then that's fine. And your opinion that he has more experience or something like that, very, very subjective. And there's not much, you know, you can do about that.
There's a really good point as far as one of the best ways to head off a protest is an effective debriefing. And you're right. I've had many a debriefing. I use the term protest fodder. Is I have to make sure I'm not giving them protest fodder. And to hear Christy's perspective, it's like, no, I want the protest fodder because it's going to tell me whether or not I should protest. And so we have this differing viewpoint of what should happen. And a part of the challenge is how do we make the debriefing effective enough to give them context?
Industry comes in, unfortunately, now many times with a chip on their shoulder. And they do. They're unhappy. They haven't won. They are looking for something to protest. So the contracting officer walks in knowing that because he's already sent the letter saying, you didn't win. And you've gotten the phone call that says, what do you mean we haven't won? We're wonderful. And you already know that it's going to be a contentious moment in the room. I always get very, very worried when they say, we're bringing our lawyer, because you don't have to bring your lawyer. That room can be very, very tense. So yeah, at that point, you're then going to just be very, very careful what you say. Very, very careful.
Yeah, it's an interesting point of the bringing the attorney into the room for the debriefing. It sets a tone.
If you bring your gun, I'm bringing my gun.
Well, and there's a question. If I'm the government, I always brought my attorney to the debriefing because I wanted to bring my gun. But am I setting the tone that when I bring my attorney that you're going to bring yours?
At my agency, last agency, it was if they didn't bring one, we sort of didn't bring one. But if they brought one, we brought ours.
Okay. So, yeah, there's a good lesson for the contracting officers listening is you don't have to have an attorney at the debriefing.
And I think nowadays, because of the contentious atmosphere, most have opted to have a lawyer in the room because they feel safer. I don't think it's, again, the call of the contracting officer, whether or not to invite his lawyer into the room.
So, okay, I'll go back to Christy. When under the question of should I protest, what's a reason that you jump out and say, yes, this is something worth protesting versus when it's just not worth doing?
Well, the first thing is the cost to protest and versus the benefit you hope to get if you're successful in the protest. And sometimes it's not an even thing or even a beneficial thing. You have to also consider what are you doing to your relationship with your customer? So you want to make sure you have really valid grounds for your protest. And I mean, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but you don't want to be protesting just for the sake of protesting. So those are the two big factors from the industry side in whether or not you should protest.
Another one that jumps out to me is it going to get you what you want? In other words, is your goal to win the contract, which that's usually what it is, right? Well, if you know that you're not even lowest price and it's a lowest price technically acceptable source selection, you're not going to get there from here. Doesn't matter if they evaluated you unfairly. It does functionally, but the end goal is for you to get the contract. Well, if you weren't the lowest price, unless you think they evaluated your price unfairly, the reality is you're not going to get the contract anyway. So it's the whole thing of like, if you knock out the number one, but you're number 17, you're not going to leap over the other 16 people and get the contract. So that's one of the big things that from an industry perspective that I've learned since coming to this side.
The other grounds for protest is that the winner was not technically acceptable. They may have been the lowest price, but if they weren't technically acceptable, that would be a basis for protest. The problem is you don't get enough information in your debrief to be able to say that or to be able to justify that. But if you could do it, that would be a protestable ground.
Yeah, and that's a tough one to prove.
Exactly. It is very tough to prove. You'd have to make the argument that the other guy's stuff didn't do what it said. You know, couldn't produce, say it was a copy machine, couldn't produce 30 pages a minute, and that's what you said in your requirement. And I know for a fact, based on his stuff, it only does 28 pages a minute.
And if it's something binary like that, that would work. But a lot of times it's a judgment call. Like back to your point about people. Yeah. It's like, I think this guy needs a PhD. I think his PhD isn't from Harvard, or my guy's PhD is from Harvard, and your guy's is from, you know, Uncle Bob's house of PhDs. That's a judgment call. I mean, you don't win that battle, but you spend a lot of time fighting it.
But in defense of industry, one of the things that when I did services stuff that I've seen people try and do is, and I pushed back very, very hard was, I've seen a lot of times where they put requirements in, especially on the DoD side, for service time. Military service time. And I was like, that's unduly restrictive. I feel that is unduly restrictive to sit there and say, well, you know, they have had to be a E3 working in this industry for 7 years. Really unduly restrictive in a technical environment to sit there and say, you're just trying to hire somebody that, you know, is retiring. And that to me is unduly restrictive. But, you know, I actually do look out for industry once in a while.
We actually had one of our customers, that was something that they were working their way through. The RFI required that you were a E9 with, I think it was like 8 years of experience after retiring. It was obviously written for a particular person. And our customer, the one who were helping shape the requirement, he had actually been an E7. And he's like, can I fight this? And yeah, which to your point, Steve, is that that's unduly restrictive. It got kind of messy. It's not easy to do, but that stuff happens. I don't think it's necessarily something you're going to win through a protest, but making the government aware that, like, do we know this requirement needs to be that specific? Does the actual experience of the person having been active duty at a certain rank going to make that big of a difference?
Well, your remedy is to approach the contracting officer who, you know, is then going to go back and ask if he's not understanding that that's what the customer is trying to do, is shape it for one particular person to come in and get the job. You can, and I would probably say it's probably in your interest to file a protest if you think you have qualified personnel who can do the job. don't try and stretch an E5 with an associate's degree to an, you know, for an E9 requirement and, you know, a lot more experience. If you have an industry, a non-military equivalent in that particular case, an engineer with lots of experience, for example, or some category of that, then, you know, make the argument, don't try and stretch people because you're going to probably lose there and you're going to waste time, as Christy said, and money.
To help people understand whether or not they should protest, is there anything specifically that the government should do?
The only thing I would speak to is protesting a decision that a contracting officer makes in the process of a contract you've already had. Be very, very careful to have tried every way to resolve that and then get a final decision from a contracting officer saying, no, you know, you're going to do this before you file that protest. Because GAO, I think, in many cases will turn around and say, well, did you try and resolve the dispute? So it's very real important for industry in that realm to try all sorts of resolution, alternative dispute resolutions, all that kind of stuff, ADR. You do all that stuff before and then get that final contracting officer decision in writing before you file that protest. You have to resolve it before you kind of go to GAO.
Now, what if they can't get the CO to engage? What if they can't get that?
That's not a protestable issue. What happens is if they can't get the CO to engage, then and you're impacted and he's going to have to make a decision at some point, either terminate you or come in with a, you know, something that says you're going to do something. And then that's the point where you say, look, that's just either you file a claim or you file a protest, one or the other. And I'm sure we have a podcast on claims.
It's coming. It's going to be Shelley doing that one, actually.
There you go.
So Christy, what do you think from the industry perspective, what can be done to answer that question of whether or not we should protest?
To be prepared to answer that question, you want to make sure that you really understand what the requirements were. And the best way to do that is to review the RFP when it comes out and ask all of the questions you can possibly imagine to get information that will help you do a fully compliant proposal. And then the second thing, of course, is the debrief. Go to the debrief. Make sure you ask for it in the required time and get as much information as you can in the debrief. We prepared questions in advance. We practiced asking those questions in a manner that wasn't confrontational. The preparation for the debrief on the industry side is probably every much as complex as what the government does. And I think you get it if you can get as much information as you can. That'll give you a clue whether you really have a valid reason for a protest. And I agree with Steve that a protest coming out of the blue is probably not the best solution. Talking to the contracting officer first is a better approach.
Awesome. Well, this was fun. I appreciate the insight, and it's always a good discussion. And it's always great to have one industry perspective and one fully government perspective and watch the two of you kind of help our listeners understand both sides of the story. Thanks much, and we'll see you on the next one.
Okay, that's it for this episode. Thanks to our sponsor, Skyway Acquisition. Visit skywaymember.com to learn more about the Skyway community. If you want to hear one more protest story, I put it at the end after the music fades out. Thanks for joining us.
You know, one of the fun protests that I had was, it's the really cool part about what you do when you're in a big, you know, the big world. Legislation had been passed about what kind of weapon we could buy. And the legislation was, if you did a sea-launched weapon, you had to do a competition. But if you did an air-launched weapon, you didn't have to. It was in the language, in the funding language. Guys who did the sea launch stuff still protested the J&A when the air launch came out. And we had to go through the protest. And GAO actually came back and said, look, they're following the letter of the law.
Yeah.
It says they're not going after sea, they're going after air. Why that company felt they needed to do that, I still do not understand. I know they were positioning themselves for a sea launch You know, they had a system that they thought could do sea launch stuff. But we weren't after sea launch. And the weapon they were offering was so big and heavy, it can only be launched sea launch. It couldn't even be considered for air launch, because the only time it was ever used was off of big four-engine bombers, and we were talking about something for F-18s.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But they still felt that need to go in and protest, and that's one of my many funny ones.
That was an awesome example of just, that's why the CO is frustrated, because you're like, Congress told me not to do it, so here we go.
Yeah, I'm not doing it, and I'm still getting a protest.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy.